This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Given the current financial troubles in Cyprus and the now long-running Eurozone crisis, you'd think that world leaders are losing their zeal for international cooperative monetary policies, but they're not.
In the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, French President Nicolas Sarkozy, Britain's Prime Minister Gordon Brown, and Chinese Central Bank Governor Zhao Xiaoxuan all called for a fundamental rethink of the world's financial system, and they did so by invoking the memory of a historic meeting in New Hampshire's White Mountains, the Bretton Woods Conference.
Nearly 70 years ago, representatives from 44 countries gathered at one of New England's grandest hotels, the Mount Washington, to sketch out the shape of the world's new financial system. Even as the Second World War continued to grind on, the shape of the post-war world was coming into sharp focus. Britain, an empire on its knees. The United States, the new world power in political, military, and economic strength.
Here's how newsreels covered the event in 1944.
At Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, delegates from 44 allied and associate countries arrived for the opening of the United Nations Monetary and Financial Conference. Invited by President Roosevelt to the first major world financial meeting since the London Conference of 1933, they will work in the seclusion of this White Mountains resort.
The Bretton Woods Conference was dominated by two men, American Harry Dexter White and British Lord John Maynard Keynes. Keynes was the world's first celebrity economist, and White was a senior Treasury Department official and a Soviet spy, but no one knew it at the time.
Well, joining me now to talk about this fascinating history and the drama that truly played out at the White Mountains Resort, and what governments and financial markets can learn from it today? Well, we'll talk about all of that with Ben Steele. He's Director of International Economics at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he's the author of the new book, The Battle of Bretton Woods, John Maynard Keynes, Harry Dexter White, and the Making of a New World Order. Ben Steele, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's truly a pleasure to have you. So let me start with what might be sort of a simple but obvious question. Why did they choose Bretton Woods for this 1944 conference?
That's a good question. There are a lot of stories behind it, but by far the most compelling one is this. FDR's Treasury Secretary, Henry Morgenthau, was determined to find an East Coast resort way outside the wartime gloominess of Washington. And Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, had one political benefit that they couldn't find elsewhere. FDR remembered that Woodrow Wilson's League of Nations was brought down by the fact that Woodrow Wilson had not secured Republican cooperation in the Senate. And he was determined not to make the same mistake. Now, there was a Republican senator in New Hampshire, Charles Toby, who was an enemy of international institutions. He might be considered in today's terms an isolationist. And FDR figured if he could help out Toby in his upcoming hard primary battle in New Hampshire, Toby himself might become a supporter of a new international monetary and financial agreement. And that's exactly what happened. Toby did become a supporter.
Interesting. So a little political back scratching going on there. But the Mount Washington Hotel at the time was basically bankrupt. I mean, you write about how, for example, the town's entire population basically consisted of the few hotel caretakers that were left, railroad workers, and the postmaster. It wasn't really a location that was primed for the most important financial conference the world had seen in many years.
That's it. The town was really the hotel itself, and it had been closed for a full 2 years before the Bretton Woods International Conference. So, in fact, the military was very much in presence at the event, helping to prepare the hotel. They were involved in things like painting and moving furniture. I mean, this was a major, almost military operation to bring the hotel up to standard and time. They were still working on it as the delegates arrived in July of 1944.
Well, I want to talk to you about what exactly was at stake at the conference in just a moment, but there's one tiny vignette that you bring out in the book that I wanted to share with listeners. And that's about sort of, reminding us that it is 1944. It's also New Hampshire. And you mentioned that when the conference kicks off, the Chinese contingent decides to go on a hike in the mountains. And what happens to them?
That's right. The Chinese delegation at Bretton Woods was actually the second largest to the American. They go out hiking in the woods. And a New Hampshire hermit sees them and panics. He thinks they're Japanese invaders and starts shooting at them.
So a little moment there from 1944 that's possibly of a lighter note than what was really going on. I mean, there was an amazing amount at stake. I mean, in a way, you can almost sympathize with that New Hampshire hermit because we were still at war. World War II was not yet over. This is 44, not 45. So what was the goal of this economic or financial conference when we were still, you know, many months away from the end of a global catastrophe?
Right. This is the most important international gathering since the Paris peace talks in 1919. Bretton Woods takes place in July of 1944, just a few weeks after the D-Day invasion in Normandy. So there's a real sense of anxious optimism in the air among the delegates. You have delegates from 44 nations present, over 700 of them, and the FDR administration is anxious to use this conference to send the enemy Axis powers a message that is that it is the Allies who had the compelling positive global vision for the post-war world.
Hmm, interesting. Now, you know, we're speaking about this in 2013, and it's very easy to look back upon Bretton Woods through the soft focus lens of history, about as this moment where nations came together to create, you know, the new world order, at least in terms of financial and monetary systems. But you write, and this was, you know, the revealing thing in your book, that it was a very fraught affair and essentially a deep-seated, you know, as you were mentioning, philosophical and political battle between two men in particular. So let's spend a little bit of time talking about them. The first is John Maynard Keynes, the giant, one of the giants of economics. So describe to him, remind us who he is and why he was so important.
Keynes is truly one of the remarkable figures of the 20th century, not the world's greatest economist at the time, but the world's first international celebrity economist. He is the media idol at Bretton Woods. The American media can't get enough of him. They're all over him. Many of them object to his ideas vehemently. There is a sense at the conference that Bretton Woods is really just a British trick to purloin American gold. But they're absolutely fascinated with Keynes, and this annoyed the U.S. Treasury to no end. They did their very best to hide Keynes away as much as possible. For example, he was not allowed to speak at the opening ceremonies, even though the British wanted him to. They wanted him to nominate Henry Morgenthau to be president of the conference. Morgenthau himself vetoed that. And Harry Dexter White, his American counterpart, put Keynes in charge of the commission to create the World Bank, specifically to keep him away from the main event, and that was the creation of the International Monetary Fund and enthroning the U.S. dollar as the world's global unit of account in the post-war world.
And we'll talk about the effects that that had in just a moment. But a little bit more about Keynes to begin with. I mean, it was, what, 1936 where, you know, his grand opus, The General Theory, came out. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. And so and this was the book one of its central tenets was the fact that governments just don't do, in his mind, they do all the wrong things when a depression hits.
That's right. They do all the wrong things in a financial crisis and when a depression hits. For example, they're all obsessed with rebalancing their budgets when what they should be concerned with is reviving economic growth. And FDR's Treasury were very much Keynesians. They not only read Keynes, but they quoted him. I mean, he was having a real influence on economic policy within the Roosevelt administration. He had, in fact, created what we call the discipline of macroeconomics today. It really didn't exist before Keynes's opus magnum in 1936, The General Theory.
And what I find so interesting is that in the book you remind us that, you know, Keynes was lordly, he was brilliant, he was the scion of long-established, you know, British families. He was a celebrity, as you said. But you also remind us that he was a horrible diplomat, and he was basically charged with representing Britain, a nation that was at its knees due to, you know, the cost of the Second World War. And I mean, you write in the book that Keynes was more concerned with cornering and humiliating opponents than converting them to his side. And you quote a British cabinet advisor saying that that man is a menace to international relations. And this is someone on Keynes's own side.
Yes, that was James Mead himself, a Nobel Prize winning economist, who actually considered Keynes to be, and I quote, God.
Well, remind us briefly, what was his primary goal? What did he want to come out of Bretton Woods?
All of Keynes's official trips to Washington during his life were begging missions. His first one was during World War I. In 1917, he's working for the UK Treasury, and he immediately makes his mark in Washington in the worst possible way. Let me give you some comments from two prominent observers at his first meetings in Washington. He is described as, quote-unquote, rude, dogmatic, and disobliging, and, quote-unquote, too offensive for words. Now, remarkably, these comments came from the British ambassador and his financial deputy. Needless to say, the Americans had much worse things to say about him.
Well, let's talk about the key American then in that case, a man who also considered Keynes a god, Harry Dexter White. You mentioned him just a second ago. He was a total surprise to me in your book. He's the son of Lithuanian Jewish immigrants, born in Boston, grew up here. But tell us about his early life, because if you look at his early life, you don't necessarily say he's the man that's going to help create the new world financial system.
He couldn't be more different in temperament, background, everything from Keynes. He really showed no great promise in life until very late. He did his undergraduate degree at age 30, but then he went off to Harvard and did a PhD, and he was moderately successful there, although he couldn't get tenure. He wound up in 1933 at a small college in Wisconsin called Lawrence College. He was definitely unhappy there. He, at that time, sends a letter to his former supervisor at Harvard saying he's studying Russian and wants to get a scholarship to go off to Moscow to study economic planning. But just before he's able to put that in motion, he gets a letter from a Treasury economist, a very noted economist in his own right, Jacob Viner, asking him to come to Washington temporarily to work on a monetary policy study. And he goes in 1934, and he never looks back. He spends the rest of his career in Washington, and it's a truly remarkable career built based on a symbiotic relationship with one man in particular, FDR's Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau. These two form a real bond that's almost unique in Washington.
Well, White was born in Boston, as we mentioned. The details of his life are just fascinating. As a young boy, he lived in a tenement at the foot of Beacon Hill. One of the reasons why he was a late bloomer, so to speak, not going or graduating from college at Stanford until he was 30, was that he spent much of his younger years helping run his father's hardware and crockery business. But then, as you say, he forms this incredibly close relationship with the Secretary of the Treasury. And, as you mentioned, he had designs to go to Russia. So tell us more about his attitude and his view of Russia and then what became the Soviet Union.
Okay. In 1934, Henry Morgenthau becomes Treasury Secretary. This is not a man who knows anything about economics, but he happens to be a close personal friend of FDR's from Hyde Park. He becomes entirely dependent on Harry Dexter White for policy ideas, and nobody has a greater knack for translating ideas into policy than Harry Dexter White. But Harry Dexter White is a far more ambitious man than that. He's also a very passionate political thinker. In 1924, for example, he was a major supporter of Fighting Bob La Follette's Progressive Party campaign for the presidency. In 1948, he was a big supporter of Henry Wallace's Independent Progressive Party campaign, Henry Wallace having been a great supporter of the Soviet Union. Now, Harry White, shortly after coming to Washington in 1934, gets enmeshed in a web of fellow travelers in Washington, people like Whitaker Chambers. These are couriers between Soviet intelligence and their moles within the FDR administration, And he starts this remarkable double life. He himself acted as a mole for Soviet intelligence for the better part of 11 years, from 1935 to 1946. He's feeding classified information to the Soviets. He's helping to secure positions within the administration for fellow thinkers, other moles. And he's advocating for the Soviets in policy debates. It's a really rather remarkable double life.
And how much do we know whether or not that influenced White's key position and key role at the Bretton Woods Conference?
In terms of the Bretton Woods Conference, there's no doubt that White was highly solicitous of the Soviets, who were extremely obstructionist at Bretton Woods. The Soviets had really very little interest in Bretton Woods, except for two particular reasons. They liked the idea of gold becoming the foundation of a new international monetary system, not because they wanted to participate in it, but because they had a lot of gold and were planning on digging up a lot more of it in the coming years. So this would boost the value of their gold stock. Second, they thought that they might get concessionary loans from the United States. So that's the only reason they participated. But there was no remnant of shall we say, Soviet monetary thinking and White's plan for Bretton Woods, because there was none to speak of. Having said that, there is very much a remnant of Harry Dexter White's double life that lives on today. After the conference, in January of 1946, President Truman nominates Harry Dexter White to be the first U.S. managing director of the new International Monetary Fund. And he also plans to nominate him to be the first managing director of the IMF. That is the top position. But just after this, he receives a long memorandum from FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover saying, "Don't even think of it. I can prove that this man is a Soviet spy." Now, Truman doesn't trust Hoover, but he knows he has a big political problem on his hand. So he decides to concoct a new narrative that will be presented to the British, that the Americans, after all, decided that they really want presidency of the World Bank and not the IMF. And so to this day, it's an American who runs the World Bank, and it's a European who runs the far more important institution, the IMF. This is a legacy of the White spy scandal.
Interesting. Listeners, I'm speaking with Ben Steele. He's author of the new book, The Battle of Bretton Woods, John Maynard Keynes, Harry Dexter White, and the Making of a New World Order. So, Ben Steele, we've talked in some detail about the two main figures at the Bretton Woods Conference, Keynes and White. So what came out of it? Essentially, the Americans got everything they wanted, did they not?
That's right. I mean, these two argued fiercely going into the conference for literally 2 years, continuously for 2 years. They had very different positions. Keynes wanted to establish a new international currency that would be a rival to the U.S. dollar. He was going to call it Bancor. Needless to say, Harry Dexter White would have none of this. But most importantly, Keynes was trying to preserve what he could of the British Empire, whereas it was very much part of the U.S. Treasury's wider geopolitical agenda to eliminate Britain as a rival in the post-war world, both on an economic basis and a political basis.
Can I ask you just a quick question about that? Because that was very interesting to me when I was reading your book. Because on the one hand, yes, I mean, Britain spent quite some time being the world economic and colonial power. But maybe it's easy to say looking back now, but in 1944, I mean, the Brits were going to lose India in just a couple years. The colonies were soon to be fairly dispersed. The country was already at its knees. I mean, why did the U.S. see like holding the U.K. down as more important than perhaps, you know, using England as a linchpin in an overall reconstruction of Europe plan to buttress against rising Soviet power?
That's a wonderful question. And in fact, 3 years later, the Marshall Plan really overthrew White's vision of the post-war world. We decided that we needed to contain the Soviets and save Britain from an imminent communist takeover. But that was not the view in 1944. Remarkably, FDR's Treasury, White in particular, viewed the Soviets as part of what would be a vital international alliance in the post-war world to keep Germany and Japan down. Britain, however, they saw still as America's greatest international rival. They were determined to move both financial power and political power permanently from London to Washington. And enthroning the dollar in place of sterling as the unrivaled international currency was very much part of their agenda.
Hmm. In the last couple minutes that we have, let's talk about the legacy of Bretton Woods, because in a way, its legacy is very short. It took some time to actually have the accords be fully put into place. And then by 1971, Nixon just drops the gold standard entirely. I mean, in the long run, John Maynard Keynes was basically vindicated because we have floating exchange rates right now. We don't have a gold standard.
That's right. In fact, you had at the outset mentioned the governor of the Bank of China, the Chinese Central Bank, who a few years ago in the wake of the financial crisis said that Bretton Woods may have been a big mistake. We shouldn't have pursued the American plan, the white plan. We should have pursued Keynes's plan for a new supranational currency. There's a lot of romanticism about Bretton Woods. A lot of people who are great supporters of it say, well, it lasted from 1945 to 1971, which is not bad. But it wasn't until 1961 that the first nine European countries met the requirement that their currencies be convertible into U.S. dollars. And by that time, the system was already coming under terrible strain as the U.S. was facing imminent depletion of its gold stocks. And that's what led President Nixon to close the gold window, to make the dollar inconvertible into gold at a fixed rate in 1971.
You know, I think people look around now and they see the euro, for example, and the crisis in the eurozone as being yet another, you know, possible nail in the coffin for the concept of international cooperative monetary systems. But in the book, you also write, I mean, you mentioned China, that, for example, if the U.S. and China, that they will not emerge, I mean, like a cooperative system between these two superpowers cannot emerge until each one of the countries really realizes the impact or the consequences of not creating a more mutually beneficial monetary system. But isn't that in itself the lesson of Bretton Woods, though, that nationalism can and will subvert any sort of international cooperation when it comes to financial systems?
That is the lesson of Bretton Woods. Bretton Woods was very much a nationalistic event, very much driven by the American perception of national interest at the time. And there was a deal to be done between the world's largest international creditor, the United States, and the world's largest international debtor, Britain. We would save Britain, get them through the war, in return for which the British would basically concede the foundations of its empire and allow the dollar to reign supreme as the global currency. There's not such a deal, I believe, to be done between China and the U.S. today. China, for example, as you know, has $3.3 trillion in foreign exchange reserves. The better part of that is in U.S. dollar-denominated assets, and China's very afraid of doing anything that would undermine the global purchasing power of that enormous hoard of dollar-denominated assets. So even China has an interest in trying to prop up this system.
You know, now we find ourselves in the United States having gone from being the world's largest creditor to the world's largest debtor. Do you think that would have happened if the Bretton Woods Accords never came through?
You know, that is a very good question. There's no doubt that the U.S. dollar still would have been dominant. But one key feature of Bretton Woods is enshrined in the IMF Articles of Agreement was that the U.S. dollar was effectively a surrogate for gold, the only surrogate in the world for gold. And Harry Dexter White, when he was defending Bretton Woods before the U.S. Congress in 1945, said he could foresee absolutely no circumstance at any time in the future when the U.S. would not be able to back the dollar by gold. But that's precisely what happened in the 1960s when countries like France started to say, this system is unfair. The United States is producing too many dollars for the world, and we demand our gold back. In fact, the French sent a battleship to pick up their gold in the early 1970s.
Well, it's an absolutely fascinating history and a fascinating read as well. The new book is The Battle of Bretton Woods, John Maynard Keynes, Harry Dexter White, and the Making of a New World Order. It's by Ben Steele, who joined us today. Mr. Steele, thank you so much for your time.
Again, thanks so much for having me.
And listeners, there's more of that newsreel footage at our website, radioboston.org. Stick with us, because coming up, it's almost time for baseball. Only a Game's Bill Littlefield joins us to talk sports. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.